Our speaker tonight is someone that many of you are familiar with, whether or not you've met him. Let me tell you just a little bit about him, and I don't want to take much of his time, but when I first decided that I was serious about getting sober, and I got a sponsor, and we got into the step work immediately, and somehow I got a hold of a set of four CDs, and the CDs were called, the name of the set was called The Sometimes Quickly, Sometimes Slowly Approach, I believe, or anyway, to that effect. And I listened to those CDs over and over and over and over and over. At the time, the speaker did not even know my name, but he has no idea how much he helped me to get sober. And every time I get a new sponsee, that's the first thing I do is get them a set of those four CDs and a big book and get them started in that. So without further ado, I'd like to introduce and help me. Let's give a big Ridgeview welcome to Ken B.
Good evening. My name's Ken, and I'm an alcoholic. And good yontif also to anybody who that would apply to tonight. I don't have a big book nearly this fancy. Thank you to whoever loaned it to me. I promise I won't tarnish it nor its reputation this evening. I almost brought my book, but then I thought, when I got sober, I had, when I was drunk, I was about 13, I got popped for a bunch of felonies, and I got sent to this treatment center, and the director of the treatment center gave my mother the book, Alcoholics Anonymous, and said, your son's not ready yet, but someday he's going to need one of these, and you should keep it around. And so when I got sober, well, when I went to my first AA meeting, I said I was 17. I said, you know, Mom, I need $5 to buy this book. They have Alcoholics Anonymous, and I figured I'd get a case of beer. That's how much it cost back then. And she said, oh, we have one of those. So she gave me this book, and I was like, well, that's suspicious. And you know, we tend to be a little on the paranoid side, which is why I did not bring my own book tonight, because I figured you would think like I did, that I had made up a lot of what was in it just to fit what I was saying, because I was convinced that my mom had written this book about me, because it had all the things I had done in it, and it had all the things I thought, and I'd always thought that people were listening to what I thought. I didn't wrap my head in tinfoil or anything, but I was close. And so I was pretty sure that she had written this book and put it there so that I would find all this stuff and then get convinced that I really had a problem with drinking, because I was quite certain I did not have a problem with drinking. I conveniently had a problem with drugs when I was going to AA meetings, because that way I didn't fit in there. And when I went to NA meetings, I conveniently had a problem with alcohol, and smoking pot really wasn't a big deal. So, you know, nothing worried me about Narcotics Anonymous either. I pretty much had all the bases covered. I was safe. I was thinking when I was on my way over here tonight that I was remembering that when my first job, when I got out of the military, I did federal law enforcement in the U.S. Coast Guard, and I got out of the service, and my first job was as a adolescent mental health counselor at a treatment center, and I was thinking about what it was like back then with the guys and the girls that I was working with when we would go to a meeting, and I thought, there's two groups of people at a meeting at a treatment center. There's the people who go home at the end of the night, and then there's the people who get locked down at the end of the night. and get tackled on their way down the driveway if they try to join the other group as they're leaving the building. And I thought, I remember those days. It was exciting. So if you're one of the people that's going to get locked up tonight and get to enjoy the hospitality of this place for another 24 hours, the good news is you don't have to worry about drinking tonight. The bad news is that it may take a while before you ever find yourself in Alcoholics Anonymous. The statistics for those of us that are in a treatment center are fairly low. The good news is that the statistics for those of us that are in Alcoholics Anonymous are really high. In the foreword to the second edition on Roman numeral 20 in the book, it says, of those who come to AA and really try, about 75% or so get sober. That's an astounding statistic. The last survey that I remember reading said that 67% of the people in Alcoholics Anonymous have 5 years or longer in sobriety. So I know that when you're in treatment, you feel a lot of pressure for a lot of stuff. And the moment that you get out, for some reason, all that pressure goes away. And all of a sudden, this thought comes of, you know, I really wasn't like those people. I could drink again and it would be okay. Especially now, you know, that I've been sober for 28 days and I got a chip and everything. You know, bronze chip. Do they give those out here? You get do you get to chip out when you're done with treatment? That's awesome, isn't it? So when I chipped out of treatment, I left treatment. I was 17. That was my second treatment center and third mental hospital in a period of about 2 weeks. But I stayed there for the full 28 days. So I guess this was 6 weeks or so later. And they used to, when you would get to go home, you know, they would, you'd sit in the middle of the room, half the size of this room, half of the many people, and everybody would sit around and tell you what was wrong with you and why you weren't going to make it. And they called it the hot seat. I don't know, is that still like therapeutic, Sam? Do they still do the hot seat? No, that's good. So I got sober in 1986. Psychology hadn't quite evolved that much yet. So they had the hot seat, and they would tell you. And so I sat in the hot seat, and I remember thinking, everybody said, you're not going to make it 90 days. And I said, I'm going to prove you wrong. I know I'll make it 90 days. And me and this other fellow, we both got out at the same time. And I was 17 when I had gotten into the treatment center, and it was the public health treatment center for Pinellas County, and there were no locks on the doors. The only condition was that if you left, you weren't allowed to ever come back. And the sentence for those people that left was death. So locking the doors wasn't really a deterrent for leaving. Most people were pretty excited about staying there. I still didn't get the gravity of the situation I was in. It was a shocker for me when I figured it out. I don't think I really got it till about 5 years of sobriety, but you may be a little sharper than me. This is actually a mental health treatment center. It's not like a day spa. I didn't realize that, you know, like you're locked up in a mental institution. You know, like that's what everybody else in the world called the place I was in. The place I had come from, they brought me to in a straitjacket. I knew that was really a mental institution, but I thought since I was a juvenile, it wouldn't be on my record, so it wouldn't really count. And I found out later that it still counts. You got locked up in a straitjacket in a mental hospital. As far as sobriety is concerned, you're nuts. So I was in this treatment center, and it was the bottom of the barrel, last stop on the block place for a lot of people. Most of the people in there either came out of prison or out of from under the bridge, and you know they were long-term, hardcore, getting ready to die alcoholics. And there was no insurance that paid for it. It was it cost $212, and make the most of it while you're there, because it's the last chance you got kind of place. And I got out of there after 28 days, and me and this other fella got out, and he didn't have to sit in the hot seat because everybody thought he was wonderful. And and we got out at 9 o'clock in the morning, and it, huh? Yeah, not so, I'm used to it. So everybody, you know, was like, you know, cheering us on when we left. It was 9 o'clock in the morning. We lived in the same neighborhood. And we didn't know each other. He lived in a different section of the complex that I was in. And we got home probably around 10 or so. And we were going to go to a noon meeting together. So at 11, I walked over to his house to go to the noon meeting, and he was already drinking. And when I left treatment, they said 6 to 8% of you may make it. And I didn't believe them, because I loved all the people there so much by the time I left. You know, I just couldn't imagine. They're so great. We shared so much. Why would they ever want to drink again after what they said happened to them? So, you know, I was shocked. But I went to the noon meeting by myself, and I stayed sober 90 days. A week before my 90-day chip, a friend of my dad's gave me a joint to celebrate my 90 days with. Now, understand, I had gone to a 28-day treatment center. I had gone to 90 meetings in 90 days. I'm sure I had a sponsor, this guy named Barry. And I asked Barry to be my sponsor because Barry had this big gold chain. And when I got sober, they said, find somebody who has something you want. And I figured that, because I still kind of had that mentality, I figured I'd be able to steal that gold chain from Barry. So Barry was my sponsor. That never worked out for either of us, apparently. But I got that joint, and I knew I wasn't being too smart. That's the funny thing about alcoholism. We know a lot of the times that we're not being too smart, but knowing it doesn't do a damn bit of good. It's the craziest thing, you know? When I'm standing there cooking dinner, and I look down at the red burner on the stove, and I think to myself, that would really hurt if I put my hand on it. I think that would not be too smart. And I've never once put my hand on it just to see if it really is hot. You know, because I've got one of those glass ones that, you know, it's like, it's not really on fire, it's just a light, so it shouldn't be that hot. But like in my head, I know that wouldn't be smart and I don't do it. But for some reason, whenever the question of, well, maybe I could drink again and it would be different this time came up, I knew at some time, sometimes I knew I wasn't being too smart, but that never deterred me from doing it. Not even once. Not even when I had left an AA meeting. It was one of my periods of short-term sobriety in the beginning, and I had gotten a job at this place that it was like a thing where people held meetings. So they served food and, you know, all this stuff, and you would go there and you would have your meeting and they would serve dinner and drinks and all this stuff. And I had been to an AA meeting earlier that day, and I was there at work, and the fellow that I was working with, there were two of us, he was mixing up these pitchers of something, and I said, what's that? And he said, kamikazes. I said, what's a kamikaze? You know, that sounds Japanese. I'm sure it's fun. And he said, you've never had a kamikaze? And I said, no. And he said, well, let's do one. Well, I remember mixing up some pitchers of kamikazes. I don't remember serving those people the rest of their dinner. We got the main course out, but I don't know what happened after that. I do know that when I went back after about a week to get my paycheck, they didn't really enjoy seeing me. They were not happy at all. And apparently we got drunk on kamikazes and left while all those people were there having their dinner and went about doing whatever we were going to do. That was, for me, that was the way the end of my drinking was. I didn't start out drinking with that intention. You know, I never took the first drink thinking, oh, you know, I want to get in a car and drive to Daytona Beach and disappear for 3 days and have the state troopers call my parents and ask if they know where I am, because they found my car in an intersection with the lights on and nobody was there, you know. That's just never the way it started out. It always started out like, this would be fun and it'll be a good idea. That did happen on more than one occasion, unfortunately. And, you know, God bless Al-Anon. And God bless my mom, because she needed all the help she could get. I stayed drunk. That was when I went to that treatment center. It was August or September of 1985. I was 17. I stayed drunk until July of 1986, and my sobriety date is July 11th, 1986, and I don't know exactly why it took that long for me to get sober, which, incidentally, that's one of the reasons why the name of the CD set is the Sometimes Quickly, Sometimes Slowly Guide to Alcoholics Anonymous, because a friend of mine, Paul, our friend over there, collaborated on that project with me. Actually, it couldn't have happened if it wasn't for Paul, and I'm grateful for your help. A friend of mine, Eric, that helped organize the stuff with it on it for me, we were trying to come up with a name, and we looked at each other, and we realized that it took both of us so long to get this thing that the obvious name was the Sometimes Quickly, Sometimes Slowly Guide to the 12 Steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, because we were sometimes slowlies for sure. And that was my story, and you don't have to have that be your story. And don't take that away from what I'm saying tonight. It's relapsing is not a requirement. It's not mandatory. You can come here, you can go to treatment, you can just come into AA, you can do it any way you want to do it, but you can come to the realization that you're an alcoholic and then come to the second part of the first step, which is the realization that your life is unmanageable, which means that no matter what I ever do, I'll never be able to manage drinking successfully. I just can't run it. I just can't do it. No matter what I do, it's never going to work out. No matter how I try to work it out, I'm always going to land on my face. I always get drunk, and it always gets worse. It never gets better. You don't have to go through the relapsing and all that stuff that I did, but that's what, you know, what my story is. I bounced in and out of AA for, you know, that 8 or 10 month period, and every time I came back to AA, I had a plan for how I was going to work it out and how things were going to happen differently and this, that, and the other. And the last time that I came back to AA, I had no plan. And I think that's why it worked for me that last time, hopefully, that I picked up a white chip. I had no idea what to do, and I was hopeless. Hopeless and desperate. No chance whatsoever of stopping on my own. I had come to that conclusion. And for me, there's a line in the Big Book, in either There Is a Solution or More About Alcoholism, where it says that the alcoholic has to fully concede to his innermost self. And up until that point, I don't think I had fully conceded. And it almost sounds redundant the way Bill writes it, but it's not. I had conceded lots of times, like, geez, I'm an alcoholic. I went to lots of AA meetings and said I was an alcoholic. I called people up and said I'm an alcoholic. You know, people said alcoholic and I'd raise my hand. You know, I went to schools and spoke, said I was an alcoholic. You know, I told everybody I was an alcoholic, but I drank again. Because knowing that you're an alcoholic doesn't do anything to help you stay sober. It's just knowing some more stuff about yourself. And Dr. Bob said, shortly before his passing, and it's in one of our pamphlets. He said, let's not muck this thing up with talks of psychological discovery. And I think for me, that when I look back, I can see that in the beginning that I spent too much time talking about how I felt and worrying about how I felt and worrying about a lot of things that had nothing to do with whether or not I was going to follow the directions to stop drinking, you know? So what happened for me was that after my last drunk, which started on July 3rd of 1986, a friend of mine had his grandparents' house had gotten broken into, and his parents told him to go down there and meet the police. And so we drove down to St. Pete to meet the police and got the report, this, that, and the other thing. And then the police left, and we looked around, and we realized that whoever broke in didn't steal the liquor cabinet, which seemed really stupid. Like, why would you break into a house and not steal the liquor cabinet? So we stole the liquor cabinet, and we put it in the back seat of the car. And then we got the next bright idea, which was, let's drive to South Carolina and buy fireworks. And two 18-year-olds and a 1970 Chevy Camaro with an 8-track player, a liquor cabinet, a bag of dope, and fireworks. It's just not going to turn out well. So at 11:30 at night, we left to go to South Carolina to buy fireworks. And I remember this sense of everything's going to be okay, because I had a gallon of rum or vodka between my legs and a bag of dope, and I was smoking a joint and I was drinking my bottle, and everything was okay. That's my last drunk. And that's the way all of my drunks started. Every single one of them started with, it's going to be okay now. 9 o'clock or so the next morning, we were in North Carolina. And just in case you didn't finish school geography, South Carolina, when you're leaving Florida, comes before North Carolina. But I was in a blackout, so I forgot where we were going. So I just drove because everything was okay. And we're in North Carolina, and my friend Chris was beside himself. He's like, we're in the middle of North Carolina. How do you, and if you've ever driven up I-95, when you enter South Carolina, there's this huge flashing neon sign that says south of the border, and it's got some guy named Pedro with a sombrero on it, and he's shooting off fireworks. So if you were driving to South Carolina to buy fireworks, you would put two and two together at that point and realize you had arrived at your destination. Wasn't the case for me, because that's what happens when you're in blackout. By the way, just so you know, I had never had a blackout up until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. My first AA meeting, I listened to what all you said. The guy took me to my first AA meeting, and you know, he introduced that I was new. I guess they probably knew it because I had shirts with buttons on them, and nobody else was dressed nice at all. But I had to impress the people there the fact that everything was just fine. And so I go to my first AA meeting, and I listened to what they said, and I worked the steps that I was obviously willing to work, that I knew I needed to work. And the first step didn't apply to me. The second step didn't really apply to me. Third step, fourth step, I didn't know what that was about. I definitely wasn't admitting to anything to anybody, because they lock you up for that. And then I could do six and seven, because I didn't know what those really meant. And the ninth step stuff, I was like, and then I got down to the whole thing about meditating and helping people, and I was like, I could do that, you know, I'm qualified for that. And so I listened to what they said in the AA meeting the first time I went there, and you know, the subsequent times that I went there, and I never had any of the same problems they had. As a matter of fact, it was interesting, is I didn't have any specific problem that they happened to be talking about at that moment at any AA meeting. If they were talking about a problem, I was going, it's good that you have this, you know, because it's not for me. It's not me. But you got free cigarettes and free coffee. And that was good. So I kept going to AA. Yeah, they used to smoke cigarettes. I know, it's a shocker. And for free, everywhere you went in AA, they'd give you cigarettes. So I never got to the point where I saw that the drinking that I was doing was having the effect on me that it was having. And so what happened for me over those months of bouncing in and out of AA was that I started to notice that some of the stuff they were saying in the meetings was happening to me. And it's interesting is when I look back now is I know that that morning on July 4th when I woke up in North Carolina, well, I didn't wake up, I was driving, but when I came to in North Carolina, I remember thinking this is really bad, this is really bad because that's a blackout. And I've got a whole liquor cabinet to drink before I go back to AA, so I can't have blackouts right now. So we drive back to South Carolina, we buy the fireworks, drive back to Florida, and had this great plan about how we were going to sell all these fireworks, make all this money, and da 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 da. And I had that plan several times. The one thing about alcoholics is we are just eternal optimists. We're always planning great outcomes for really shitty events. It's going to turn around any minute now and work out. It's all going to be good. So I wandered around. I had been thrown out of my mom's house at that point, and so I just kind of wandered around, I guess, for about 6 or 7 days, and somewhere around the 10th or 11th or 12th, somewhere in there, I walked over to my cousin's house, and I remember, like it was yesterday, the feeling that I had. I had the feeling of, I can't keep doing this, and I don't know how to stop. I couldn't drink enough to get drunk. I drank a lot, and I couldn't get drunk. No matter how much I drank, I couldn't get back to it's all gonna be all right, Excuse me. That feeling I had when I opened up that bottle of liquor and started driving to South Carolina, it's all gonna be all right. I couldn't get back to that feeling. No matter what I did, I couldn't get back to it. And so I went over to my cousin's house, and my aunt and her girlfriend were cooking dinner, and they're all sitting around the table, and it's one of the many conversations of what are we going to do with Kenneth, and I'm sitting there, and Sharon, my aunt's girlfriend, yells out from the kitchen, she's washing something in the sink, and she goes, "Take him to AA," and she had actually been sober for 20 years. She had stopped going to meetings, but she still was sober. And so my aunt says, "Take him to AA." So my cousin puts me in the car and takes me to AA. And the meeting had just ended, and so she dropped me off at this Village Inn or Denny's where they had the meeting after the meeting. If you do anything while you're in Alcoholics Anonymous, go to the meeting after the meeting. It's way better than the actual meeting. Way better. It's a lot of fun. So when you go to the meeting after the meeting and they know that you've been drinking, they put you in the middle. So they sit, whenever you go out with people in AA, they sit at a big U-shaped table for some reason. It's like the hostess at the restaurant knows who you are. And so they put you at this big U-shaped table, and the control freaks always sit on the edges. And they put the newcomer, apparently there are some people that sit on the edges here, and they put the newcomer in the middle of the U. So I was in the middle of the U, and then they just talk the whole time. And you really don't get to say much, because there's nothing you're going to say that's going to make a difference for any of them. I know that they tell you, go to an AA meeting and share how you feel, But the fact of the matter is, how you feel isn't going to do you any good, and it's not going to do the rest of those people any good either. So raise your hand and ask for help. That'll do you some good. They don't want to listen. When I got sober, they used to say, take the cotton out of your ears and stick it in your mouth. And they would tell you, there's nothing you've got to say that's going to improve my sobriety at all. But you may help some people get drunk if you keep talking. So I sat in the middle of the U, and I just sat there till about 11 o'clock at night, and then everybody was leaving, and I really didn't know where to go or what to do, and so I just kind of started walking home, and I was walking down this road in the middle of the night. It was 11:30, 12 o'clock at night, and for the first time ever, well, when I was like 11, 12, or 13, I had prayed a little bit, you know, and I said, God, please take me out of this, because it sucks. My existence was not tolerable, and that's why I drank. I couldn't tolerate living in my skin, and that's why I drank. And God didn't take me out of it. So as far as I was concerned, God either didn't exist or didn't really care. But that night, I looked up in the sky and I said, God, I can't do this. I need help. I'll do anything. Just show me what to do. The next morning, well, I had this, I used to be able to sneak back into my mom's house. I would shimmy up this wall to the laundry room and then climb across this trim piece on the second story and go in through this window that the lock didn't work on. And she didn't even know I'd be hanging out in there. But so I woke up the next morning, and I rode my bicycle down to the clubhouse where they had the AA meeting, and there was this guy Norman, and Norman was standing up on the steps of the clubhouse, and he had his hands, thumbs in his belt, and he's kind of rocking back and forth. And Norman had red hair and a red beard, and he was from Boston. And his accent was just grating. And I was born in Amherst, Massachusetts, so it really should have, like, attracted me just by my nature, but it didn't. So Norman says, coming back from a drunk, Kenny? And I said, yep. And he says, you got a sponsor yet? And I said, nope. And he says, well, you do now. Now, I've been to AA for like 10 months, so I knew the rules, you know, and you can't tell anybody else what to do in AA, you know, and you can't tell anybody you're going to sponsor them, all this stuff. I knew all the rules, but I remember that I had said, okay, whatever you tell me to do, God, I'm going to do it. And so I didn't say no. Norman wrote his phone number down on a piece of paper. And on the back of the piece of paper, he wrote, call before you drink. And that had never occurred to me. 10 months in AA. A lot of AA dances. A lot of AA meetings. A lot of coffee with people after AA. Call before you drink never came up. Or if it did, I was ignoring it. So he gave me a dime, because that's how much a phone call cost back then. And they had pay phones. The cell phone hadn't been invented yet. And he said, here's a dime. Here's my phone number. Call before you drink. And I got a white chip. And we talked for a little bit after the meeting. He said, what are you going to do? And I said, I don't know. And he said, well, why don't you go home and call me this evening? I said, okay. So at 5 o'clock, I called Norman. He said, what are you going to do? I said, I don't know. He said, why don't you go to an 8 o'clock meeting? Call me when you're done. I said, okay. So I went to an 8 o'clock meeting. I called Norman when I was done. He said, what are you going to do? I said, I don't know. He said, wake up in the morning, give me a call. I said, okay. I called him in the morning. He said, what are you going to do? I said, I don't know. He said, go to a new meeting. Call me when you're done. This went on for 5 days. Just like that. I called Norman when he told me to call him. He said, what are you going to do? I said, I don't know. He told me, go to a meeting and call me when you're done. And so at the end of 5 days, I called Norman from the payphone. He said, what are you going to do? I said, I don't know. He said, be at my house at 6 o'clock. I was like, now we're on to something. I thought we were really making progress. And I showed up at Norman's house, and Norman opens the book, Alcoholics Anonymous. We sit down, you know, hang out for a minute. He opens the book, Alcoholics Anonymous, and he reads from the foreword to the first edition of the book, Alcoholics Anonymous, and it says, rarely have we seen a person fail who is thoroughly, it doesn't say that. It says, to show other alcoholics precisely how we have recovered is the main purpose of this text. And he looked at me, I mean, dead straight in the eye. He probably even leaned forward a little bit in his chair. And he said, you've never followed the precise set of directions. And that's why you keep getting drunk. He had me, cold. I mean, right there on the spot. I had no retort. It was true. I'd gone to a whole lot of AA meetings. I'd smoked a lot of free cigarettes. I'd gone to conventions. I'd gone to dances. Gone to coffee. Had friends in AA. Did all sorts of stuff. But I had never followed the precise set of directions. And then he skipped forward in the book to page 84. The bottom of page 84 and the top of page 85, it says, we've ceased fighting anything or anyone, even alcohol, for by this time sanity will have returned. We'll seldom be interested in liquor. If tempted, we recoil from it as from a hot flame. We react sanely and normally. We will find that this has happened automatically. We'll see that our new attitude toward liquor has been given us without any thought or effort on our part. It just comes. That is the miracle of it. We haven't sworn off, nor are we fighting temptation. And he looked at me and he said, that's what you'll get if you'll follow the directions. And you don't ever have to feel as bad as you feel right now again. And they had been telling me that all this time. As a matter of fact, the reason why I kept coming back to AA was because they told you this is a way of life second to none. That's the thing I heard that made me come back. A way of life second to none. I did not know that that meant a method of actually living life, like a thing I had to do. I thought it was just going to happen to me, but it still kept me coming back. Because the way of life that I had was second to a lot of ways. Like what I was doing was not working. For me, or for any of the other people around me. It wasn't even working for the people I drank and got high with because they wouldn't tell me where they were going so I could go find them. It was like a let's avoid hanging out with Ken party all the time. Serious. It's pretty bad when you're 16 and you're hanging out at a biker bar and they don't even want you there. That's bad. And you know, that's as bad as it was for me. So I don't know why, but at that moment I was willing to follow those directions. And so we started working the steps. And I had started working the steps with people before. Lots of times, you know, if you come to enough AA meetings, somebody takes pity on you and they're like, come on, let's go through the book, or let's do this, or let's do that. And they do it because it's going to keep them sober. They really don't care if you get it or not, and they're pretty sure you're going to get drunk later, but it's going to keep them sober, so they do it. So I was like everybody's probably default 12-step person, you know. They're like, I'll go work with Ken because I'll get grateful. And so I remember I was working through the steps in the 12 and 12 with a guy, which is a novel idea because the 12 and 12 doesn't give you the directions for how to work the steps. But we would read the step out of the 12 and 12, and then his name was Nick, and he would look at me, and he would go, "Do you get it?" And I'd be like, and I knew he really wanted me to say yes so he could leave. So I would go, "Yeah, I think so." He's like, "Okay, good. Well, let's get together next week, and we'll work step two." You know, and I'm, okay. And, you know, you can't get sober working the steps out of the 12 and 12 because there's no work to be done in the 12 and 12. So normally I start working the steps in the big book, and I get about 60 days into things, and we're moving along and meeting every couple of days or every week, reading through the book together. And then Norman gets a job where he has to leave town, so he fires me, which I did not accept his resignation. So, you know, someday I'll run into him again. I'll tell him he's still kind of my sponsor, you know, even though he's not aware of it. So Norman says, you know, you really need a lot of attention, so we can't work together while I'm out of town. I was thinking, well, I could go with you, you know, because I really needed to do this thing. But Norman left to go work out of town, and I got this other sponsor, a fellow named Stuart, and you know, sponsorship relationships always start off with the best of intentions on the part of the sponsee. You know, the sponsor says, "Let's work the steps," and the sponsee goes, "Yeah, I'm really anxious to do that." And then they don't call until like the day before you're supposed to get together, and then they say, "Well, I can't do it tomorrow, I forgot," and something like that. So I did that to Stuart a lot, I'm sure. And one night, Stuart and I were at this meeting, and then we go out to Denny's afterwards, and I was eating this banana split with extra whipped cream and lots of cherries. And I'm eating this banana split, and out of the blue, Stuart goes, "You know, you're going to get drunk." I was in shock, because that was the furthest thing from my mind. And he said, "You're 90 days sober, and you're doing what you've always done." And what I always did was I stopped at the third step. I got to the point in the book in the third step where it says, being convinced, we were at step three. But I wasn't sure what I was supposed to be convinced about. So I would stop and go back because they say, you know, well, you should start over at the step before if you're not sure. And so that's bullshit. Don't do that. Write an inventory. So I was in shock, you know, and I was like, well, I don't know what to be convinced about. Stuart looks at me, goes, "You're a drunk. Go write an inventory." And that's it. You know, you're convinced that you can't stop drinking on your own, and you can't stay stopped on your own, and you're convinced that there may be some power greater than yourself. You don't have to believe in anything. Just believe that there is possibly something, or just be willing to believe. In the chapter to the agnostic, it says that once a person can say that he does believe, or that he's even willing to believe that there's a power greater than themselves, we assure him that he's on his way. And so that's what Stuart told me. So I went home that night and I wrote a four-step inventory. And I said, I don't know how to do it. I don't know what to do. And I'd been over the directions, I'm sure, tons of times with people, but I just ignored everything they said. And so Stuart said, write, "I'm resentful at," and then write a list after that. And then write why you're resentful. And then write what part of you gets affected from that resentment. And then write what your part is. That's all you have to do. So I went home and I wrote a resentment inventory. And that was so easy once I got started. It was like 10 o'clock at night. I sat at the table. I started writing. All of a sudden I had, you know, half a dozen pages of resentments done. So I went ahead and I wrote a fear inventory and a sex inventory. I was 18. I was so drunk most of the time, my sex inventory was very short. And very fortunate. So that was Wednesday night. Thursday night, Stuart and I got together and we did the fifth step. And it was about 5 or 6 o'clock in the evening. We sat out on this dock on Tampa Bay. We did the fifth step. And when I was done, something was different. I don't know why it works, but it does. From that point forward, I've never had the obsession to drink again. I've thought about drinking. In 2003, when my father died, I couldn't imagine not drinking. I sat in the parking lot at the place where my mom lives in my car at 11 o'clock at night on the phone with my sponsor saying I can't go inside because I'll drink. And he said, call somebody and go over there. And I called a friend of mine, you know, that I'd been sober with for a long time. And I went over to his house and I stayed there till 4 o'clock in the morning. And then that feeling passed, you know. But the obsession to drink has never returned, you know. And so I went out, started making my amends. There was a couple of amends that I did not make right away. And, you know, and I did those later. Definitely not a work the steps perfectly, you know. I did not work the steps in the method I endorse working the steps. And I can say that because I've found that my way of working the steps is not nearly as effective as the method that they wrote down in this book. So I joined, I wanted to join the military shortly thereafter. But in AA, they say wait a year before you make any life-altering decisions. So I waited for a year, and then I joined the military. But I pretty much probably decided to do it before then. And I went in the Coast Guard, went out west for 4 years, didn't connect with AA when I got out there because I got a girlfriend, and sobriety through relationship is not effective. You know, it's like my friend Elizabeth says, my life is unmanageable and I want to share it with you, you know. Just not at all effective. So I almost drank at about 2.5 years of sobriety, and I was on the beach with a bunch of guys from the station, and they were having a party, and you know, we were barbecuing salmon, they were drinking beer, and I thought, I could drink again, and it would be different this time, because I'm in the military now, and you can't get in any trouble from drinking in the military, because you'll get in a lot of trouble, so you won't do it. And so I said, I remember, they said, before you drink, pray. And I hadn't connected with people in AA, so I didn't have anybody to call. And so I took a walk for a moment, and I prayed, and I said, God, if it's a good idea for me to take a drink, let me do it. And when I got back, they had put the fire out, and they were walking down the beach dragging an empty cooler. They had run out of beer. And I got the hint. I did. The next day, I took off at lunch, and I went to a noon meeting. And I never disconnected from AA since. Throughout that time of my sobriety, probably up until about 8 years of sobriety, I had started a lot of inventories but never finished one. When I was about 8 years sober, this girlfriend I had decided to go to New Orleans with some other fella, and which seemed to me like that didn't make sense since, you know, we were in a relationship. But apparently I was like the only one that thought that everything was working well in the relationship. And so I go to the men's meeting at Triangle and 9 a.m. Saturday morning, and I'm, you know, I vomit my bullshit all over everybody there at the meeting, and which I, you know, probably did for years and years and years in early sobriety. I owe it a tremendous amends to Alcoholics Anonymous for how much crap I spewed on top of all those poor people at AA meetings, because I wasn't actually working the steps. And so this fella, Mike Boatwright, comes up to me after the meeting and he says, you ought to talk to my sponsor. He's a really great guy. And he introduces us, and we go to Dunkin' Dine, have coffee, and we start talking to him, and he says, sounds like you need to write an inventory. And so, you know, I fired him, and I called my old sponsor back from where I used to live and told him about this guy that wanted me to write an inventory, and, you know, and he said, you know, maybe you ought to call that guy back. And so I did, and, you know, hemmed and hawed for another week, and we were back at the Dunkin' Dine having coffee, and my sponsor's name is OK, and we're talking, and OK says the most obscure things, like, you know, happiness is an inside job. Like, who understands what that means? And he says, I've got a really big shoe. I'm like, what? He's like, I've got a really big shoe. I'm like, well, what does that have to do with anything? I was complaining about something with the ex-girlfriend or whatever. And he goes, you don't want it up your ass. Get busy and go write an inventory. And I was like, oh, he's kind of feisty. And, you know, so I go and I wrote an inventory. And I really didn't think I needed to, but I ended up with 52 pages of resentments at 8 years of sobriety. I was a little on the angry side. And, you know, driving up and down the highway at 90 miles an hour, chain smoking cigarettes, talking to people in AA on the phone, telling them how great everything was. And, because we had cell phones at that time. So I wrote this inventory, and we get together and we do the fifth step. And I didn't want to do a fifth step with him because I was thinking, you know, this guy's like 60-something years old, and I was like 20-something years old at the time. And I'm like, he drank during disco. What the hell does he know about what I'm dealing with, you know? And I had all, and it was all that same thing, that thinking that I had of separating myself from other people. You know, this is what makes me different than you. And for some reason, I don't remember what it was, but he said something that made me put all that away. He said something about his sponsor, and I was like, all right. And so we got together, we did the fifth step. Took hours. I mean, probably 5 hours. I hope I never do a fifth step as long as my fifth step was, and with another guy. It was torturous for him, I'm sure. And we do the whole thing, and from that point forward, I've never stopped the habit of taking inventory, you know. And so that was, you know, when I was still in school. You know, mid-20s or so, and since then, you know, it's 8 years of sobriety. I've been really consistent with taking inventory on a regular basis. I try to be consistent with taking the daily inventory, but I suck at that, to be honest. I'm just not good at it. Most of the time when I go to sleep, I forget, you know, and the next day I wake up and I remember, oh, I didn't take an inventory, and that's why I'm still pissed off, you know. So then I try to catch up and do it then. I've been real good about doing written inventories on a regular basis. You know, I believe firmly in what the book says. There's an amazing statement in the seventh step in the 12 and 12. And it says that, you know, that we go through this inventory taking process at first because we have to, you know, and we get a little humility out of that. And then we think, well, that's good enough. Thank you very much. You know, it says, but then, through this inventory-taking process, we discover the very things that we drank over to begin with, the character flaws, the things that were wrong with us. Excuse me. And so, you know, not so long ago, I was reading that, and it struck me that I've taken a lot of inventories, but I haven't gone back and looked at what were the things that I drank over to begin with, and are they still present in my life today? You know, so what character defects were those? And I made a list, you know, and I thought as far back as I could go, and I saw that, you know, as far back as I can remember, you know, like 5 or 6 years old, I did not do well with disappointment. People didn't do what I wanted them to do. I was pissed off, you know, and I didn't let go of anything, you know. If you wronged me, it stayed locked up in there. I didn't let go of it. You know, no acceptance whatsoever of other people's shortcomings. You know, it was intolerable to me that you wouldn't do better. You know, you should just do better, you know, especially if you were related to me, you know, all the way back, you know, and those were the reasons why I drank. You know, and when I look at my life today, most of the time, if I get bent out of shape about something, it's the exact same stuff. You know, and so, you know, it's like one more point for me to be grateful for in Alcoholics Anonymous and work in the 12 steps is, you know, that it still grows for me today. You know, that I don't have to be the victim of those character defects. There's nothing wrong with character defects. We all have them. The problem is when they run the show, you know, when they're running in the background and they're determining how my life is going, then that means I'm not actually living. And so I'm grateful that I don't have to deal with that happening anymore today. It's amazing. I continued to write inventories, you know, and slowly over time, my mom got sober. You know, it was the most amazing thing. She doesn't drink too much, but she got really sane after a while. You know, I have a wonderful relationship with a fantastic woman today. You know, it's not something I ever thought was really going to happen or be available for me, but it happened as a result of continuing to work the steps and look at my role in the relationships I had been in and what I did and how it impacted those relationships. And then by seeing that and praying about it, I don't have to do it again this time. You know, it's just, I can choose a different behavior. I think that for me today, the inventory taking process, which is 4 through 9, you know, in the big book, and I practice that through the 10th step, you know, on a regular basis. The inventory taking process is, it's best described as an access to a way of life that's second to none. You know, and when I look around at what I've got, and believe me, I've got challenges. You know, I've got challenges that I know most people wouldn't ever want to have to deal with. But when I look at my life and my challenges, I've got the tools to deal with those challenges. And the third step tells us, it says that this is the how and the why of it. First of all, we had to quit playing God. It didn't work. And then on the top of the next page, it says that instead of focusing on our little plans and designs, more and more we become interested in seeing what we could contribute to life. And then in the fourth step, in the fear inventory, it says the same exact thing. It says we're in the world to play the role that God assigns, and just as we do as we think he would have us, does he enable us to match calamity with serenity. And that's what I have today. That's the way of life that's second to none. It doesn't matter what goes wrong in my life. I've got the ability to match it with serenity. I may not always do it, but I've got the ability to do it. And I do it probably 70 or 80% of the time now, which is, you know, for me is amazing. You know, it's just, it's a wonderful way of life. And if you're new in sobriety, I just, you know, I can't tell you enough that it's not going to be anything like you think it is when you're sitting there today, and you can't even imagine how good it could possibly get. So if the door hits you in the ass on the way out and you do some more drinking, don't let it hit you in the ass on the way back in. Don't ever not come back, because it's here for you. There's no requirement to not drink. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. And if you do the steps, you don't have to drink. You don't have to. That's not a requirement either. Thanks for being here, and thanks for hearing me.
Thank you, Ken. If Ken does a lot of big book studies, group studies, and if you ever have the opportunity, this guy knows the big book and the 12 and 12 like the back of his hand, and he does an extremely good job of conducting those.
I forgot to mention that the CDs that Don mentioned are now available on a podcast at recoveryemporium.com. If you go to the recoveryemporium.com website, there's a thing on the left that says click to listen. You click on it. You can download it to your phone or whatever you want to do. You can listen to it anytime. It's 100% free.
Thanks, Ken.